Free will is a fundamental concept in Jewish thinking, and it is a subject of many difficulties. In fact, perhaps the philosopher whom I respect most in contemporary philosophy, Thomas Nagel, says that it's the most difficult problem in philosophy, period. So I'm taking today and tomorrow just to introduce you to some of the issues and indicate how we can solve some of the problems, but I want you to know there are unsolved problems. If we have time, maybe I'll show you how to live with some of them. But it's a concept that's impossible to avoid, so it's crucial to at least get some orientation. When I'm not restricted by the short period of time that a visiting group has, we usually spend a week or more on this subject, sometimes 2 weeks, depending upon the amount of time that we have. Okay, why is free will important? Free will is important because only free decisions are responsible, and responsibility is the bedrock of all Torah thinking. That human beings are responsible for at least many of their actions. Not always, but many of their actions. Responsibility plays a key role, first of all, because we have a rule of reward and punishment. And punishment for an action, that was not done with responsibility would be unjust, would be morally wrong, and reward, this is a more subtle point, reward for an action that was not done responsibly is incoherent. There's nothing morally unjust about giving somebody something more than he deserves. You're giving him a gift. Giving charity is usually morally positive. But it's not a reward, because he didn't earn it. Earning a reward requires the person to be responsible for what he does. So if you have a principle of reward and punishment, as we do, that's built on the concept that we are responsible for our actions. And if responsibility requires free will, as we believe it does, so then free will is absolutely necessary. That's one level. On another level, we talk about moral characteristics. People are righteous or vicious, generous or insensitive, virtuous or vicious. Those terms only make sense with respect to actions for which you're responsible. What you do, or as some would rather say, what motions your body goes through, without responsibility, doesn't reflect your moral standing at all. So, if we have a principle of reward and punishment, and we do have moral qualities, both of those are built on free will. Without free will, you have no responsibility. Without responsibility, there's no reward and punishment, and there's no moral qualities. Now, let me illustrate this for you briefly, so you'll see why this is so, I hope. And we'll see if we can take this as a basis for further discussion. If not, I'll have to do more. You're just standing at the top of a flight of stairs, facing the stairs. At the bottom is sitting Philip's 5th century Ming vase. Someone sneaks up behind George, gives him a push, he tumbles down the stairs and smashes the vase. Is George responsible for smashing the vase? Should he have to pay for the vase? No. The guy who snuck up and pushed him is responsible. Now, second case, George is trying to stop smoking, and he goes to a hypnotist once a week to give him a post-hypnotic suggestion to help him stop smoking. Thursday night, the hypnotist gives him this post-hypnotic suggestion, and then says, just for a joke, next Sunday morning, at exactly 10 o'clock, your right arm is going to shoot out in front of you like this. You're not going to remember this when you wake up, but that's what you'll do 10 o'clock Sunday morning. Fine. Sunday morning, he's visiting his friend Philip, who is giving him a tour of Philip's antiquities. And at 9:59, he situates him in front of the pedestal on which is sitting his 5th century Ming vase, and as the grandfather clock in the corner bongs the hour of 10, George's arm swings out straight in front of him and smashes the vase. And Philip says, "What did you do? You smashed my vase. Why did you do that?" And George says, "I don't know. I honestly don't know. It just happened all by itself. I can't account for it. It's the funniest thing that ever happened to me. My arm just went out all by itself." Is George responsible for smashing the vase? Should he pay for the vase? Clearly not. Why? Because it wasn't his free choice. It wasn't his free choice when he was pushed down the stairs, and it wasn't his free choice when his arms went out. What this illustrates is that if your body moves not because of your free choice, then you're not responsible for it, and you shouldn't have to bear the consequences of it. Only free decisions, only free decisions are those for which we're responsible, and therefore those for which reward and punishment and moral qualities can apply. That's why free will is so important. Everybody with me so far? Okay. Now, there are some religious concepts which seem to conflict with free will. And I will talk about a few of them today. Tomorrow we'll talk about philosophical problems of free will. And then we'll be done, so to speak. Let's start with the concept of fate. If something is fated to happen, let's suppose a human action, let's call it action for the time being, is fated. Would we have free will over that action? Would we be responsible for that action? Let's see what fate means. Fate means that this thing must happen. It has to happen no matter what else happens, no matter how you twist and turn, no matter how you try, no matter what strategy you use, this is going to happen. Where do we learn fate from? One of the classical sources is the myth of Oedipus, the Greek myth. Oedipus is fated to kill his father and marry his mother. In some versions of the myth, Oedipus learns about this, and he's horrified. So he flees his country and goes wandering. But Oedipus, you can't run away from fate. So years later, it happens that he's driving a chariot and comes to a narrow passageway, and someone else is coming down the passage on the other end, and they argue who has right of way, and they get into a fight, and Oedipus kills the other guy, and it turns out to be his father. And Oedipus travels to a foreign kingdom, and they're in terrible distress, and he saves the kingdom, and as a gift, they allow him to marry the queen, who turns out to be his mother. You see, Oedipus, that's fate. If it's fated, nothing you can do can stop it. Let me illustrate. Let's imagine Oedipus, in distress, says, "I can't face life like this," and throws himself off a cliff. What's going to happen? He can't die. He can't. Because it's fate. He hasn't fulfilled his fate yet. Now, some of my students tell me that he'll land on his father. Okay. That could be. That is to say, and be saved, because he hasn't married his mother yet. But according to fate, nothing you choose, nothing you do can avoid it. It's absolutely beyond your control. It's written into the structure of the universe that you must do these things. No, if that's the case, then indeed, there is no free will and there is no responsibility. Now, we're talking here about actions being fated. From the point of view of our discussion this afternoon, it doesn't matter whether anything else is fated. Maybe the sun's coming up and setting every day is fated. Maybe the weather is fated. Maybe your health is fated. Maybe your intelligence is fated. None of those are your actions. Those just set the environment in which you do your actions, in which you make your choices. We're only now talking about your choices and your actions. If all the conditions of the world are fated, it doesn't bother us from the point of view of this problem. All that bothers us is whether your choices are fated or your actions are fated. So, if an action is fated, then there is no free will and there's no responsibility. any religion that accepts the idea of fate is going to have to give up free will and responsibility. Now, the Torah doesn't accept that idea. Nothing is fated. Nothing must happen. Free will can always have an effect on what will happen. So, that being the case, although fate does contradict free will and responsibility, it's not a problem for Judaism, because Judaism doesn't believe in fate. And when you come across statements in Jewish sources that sound like fate, you have to appreciate that you're not getting the full picture, and that when you fill in the full picture, you'll see that the impression that you get is not correct. For example, the Talmud says that 40 days before the child is formed in the womb, a heavenly voice proclaims, so-and-so will marry so-and-so. Now, gee, the way I remember it, I had choices, and in some cases I said no, and in some cases the other person said no, and I did deliberate and sometimes go back and forth. Seemed to me like I was choosing my mate. Ah, but the Talmud says, don't be taken in by that illusion. 40 days before the child is formed in the womb, the heavenly voice proclaims so-and-so is going to marry so-and-so. Does that mean that my choosing, my deliberating, my changing of mind is only an illusion? Not necessarily. Because even that heavenly voice that proclaims that so-and-so will marry so-and-so, it does not have to come true. Even though the heavenly voice proclaims it, it doesn't have to come true. When a heavenly voice proclaims, it only means that, other things being equal, if conditions develop naturally, normally, within the expected range of variation, will it come true. But it doesn't have to come true. Indeed, in the summertime, we have a 3-week period in which we don't make any voluntary celebrations because we're mourning for the destruction of the temple. We don't make any voluntary celebrations, and you can't help it if there's a circumcision or a bar mitzvah or a bas mitzvah, but you don't make any voluntary celebrations except one. You can have an engagement party. Because the Talmud says that if you and she agree now, don't wait 2 weeks, because things might change. You have an agreement? Grab it. Now, of course, the thought is, either she's the one that the heavenly voice proclaimed, in which case she'll be here in 2 weeks, or she isn't the one having the voice proclaimed, which guess I don't want her anyway. Why am I in such a hurry? The Talmud says, no. Even if she's the one that the heavenly voice proclaimed, you could lose out. So when you hear these statements, don't take them as something which is absolutely fated. You'll read that on Rosh Hashanah, it's determined how much money you're going to make for the whole year. Does that mean that on the third day of Tishrei, after Rosh Hashanah, person says, God forbid, I've had it, I don't want to live anymore, and he commits suicide, cuts his throat. As he's bleeding to death, someone will run up and put a check in his hand before he dies, you know, for $15,000 or $25,000 or $40,000, because it was decreed at Rosh Hashanah, he's got to earn that money this year. And for him, this year is the next 5 minutes, so he's got to get the money before he dies. The answer is no. No, the decree doesn't take into account things like suicide. So is this Tosfos. There's nothing that is absolutely decreed, absolutely fated. For example, if Adam and Chava, in the Garden of Eden, if they had made the right choice, all of our history would not have happened. All of it. The whole of history would have been entirely different. If Chizkiyahu, the King Chizkiyahu, at the end of the First Temple, had composed Shira, some kind of poetical expression of the great military victory that he experienced, he would have been the Messiah, and the last 2,500 years of history wouldn't have happened. So we know that it's not fated to happen one way or another. And therefore, although fate does contradict free will, since we don't accept fate, for us it's no problem. Yeah.
But can't God see in the future?
We're not talking now about fate. That's the only problem we're addressing now. Problem of fate is the problem of making things happen against everything that we would choose. Seeing the future is another problem. It's a different problem.
But God knows what the conditions are.
But that's a different problem. It's true, but it's a different problem. It's not the problem of faith. It's the problem of foreknowledge. Foreknowledge, if we will, is a separate problem. By the time today, I'll do something with that. Yes.
If we take one of your examples of money, we end up living the full year. Like, I remember reading this in a book from my friend. Basically, he said that since God decides how much money you're going to earn before the year, it makes almost no difference whether you basically decide to do nothing or get a job, because at the end of the year, you'll have the same.
I respectfully disagree with my friend. I disagree with him. I think it's incorrect. It's incorrect. God is not promising you open miracles. Yeah.
Why don't you just say that there is faith? And when there is faith, you're just not responsible.
I'm considering a concept of faith which is blanket. In other words, we cover everything. I don't mind. In other words, my point is only that any fated action you're not responsible for. If you consider the concept, like some religions do, which group is that? One of the Protestant groups believes in faith for everything, and therefore there's no free will, and there's no direct responsibility at all. Right? If you had it for some things, it wouldn't bother you except for those things, but we don't happen to have it at all, so we don't have to worry about it. Right? I'm not saying we should design the most efficient system. I'm pointing out that our system doesn't have this problem. That's all. Yeah?
Well, my friend could be right in the sense that that Hashem would plan the fact that he would have been nothing in a year.
No, see, that's not faith. That's not faith. Faith means that this is going to happen no matter what else you do. Oedipus runs to another place. He jumps off a cliff, right? Yeah. Okay. All right, that's enough on this. Now let's go to the next one, which we do believe in, and therefore needs a little more work. I've done this for some of you, so for some of you, review and pause. This is a very important concept to get straight on. What about providence? God's providence. Providence means what God actually does in running the world. Providence means his activity. Not what he can do, but what he does do. God, like most of us, doesn't do everything he could. He decides what he wants to do, leaves some other things undone. Providence is a word that refers to what he does in running the world. Now, let's suppose that God's providence includes causing every physical event. He causes every physical event. Every change in the physical world is due to his will causing. That will include the motions of our bodies. Raising the arm, running 2 miles on the treadmill as I did a couple of hours ago. All the motions of your body, including giving charity, including committing murder, including visiting people in the hospital, including theft, all of these require the body to move. And they're all caused by God's will. The body is like a puppet on the end of strings. God is pulling the strings and making the body move. Now, if that's true, how can I be responsible for my actions? All of my actions require my body to move. I can't give charity without my body moving. I can't visit people in the hospital without my body moving. And that's all God pulling the strings. So how can I be responsible for that? Here I can't push it off, because we do believe in providence. So if there were a contradiction, we'd be in serious trouble. But here there isn't a contradiction, and that's why I'm going to explain to you why it's not a contradiction. The answer comes in three steps. Step one, God's will causes every physical event. But that statement is restricted to the physical world. It says God's will causes every physical event. There's another dimension, the spiritual dimension, and God's will does not cause every spiritual event. Some yes and some no. It divides up. The soul is a spiritual entity. Now we're coming to step two. Decisions take place in the soul, or perhaps I should say free decisions take place in the soul. free decisions in the soul are not caused by God's will. Otherwise, it wouldn't be free. So, decisions are protected. They're soul events, which means they're spiritual events, and they're not caused by God's will. That's step two. But that doesn't solve the problem. Protecting the soul in the spiritual realm and giving it the freedom to decide does not solve the problem. Because the problem was that the actions for which I'm supposed to be responsible require the body to move. The soul cannot give charity. The soul can do whatever it wants in the spiritual realm. That's not giving charity. For charity to be given, my hand has to go in my pocket, pull out a coin, and hand it over. So what we need is some connection between the soul's decision on the one hand and the body's motion on the other hand. Now, of course, we can't just tie them together. We can't say that the soul's decision causes the body to move, can we? That's not going to work here. Why not? Because what was the problem we're facing?
God controls what your body
that
does.
God causes the body to move. That was the problem. To say the soul does it is just to forget what the problem was. The problem is that God is causing the body to move. Let the soul make its decisions as it likes. If the soul's decision is unrelated to what the body does, then it doesn't help me become responsible for what the body does. So there is a connection, not the direct connection of causing, but an indirect connection. And here's how the connection works. Yes, God causes every physical event. But we have to ask, how does God decide what physical events to cause? What does he take into account? What are the facts upon which he decides what to make happen? Part of the answer is this. One of the things he takes into account is the decision that happens in the soul. God has a policy of almost always causing the body to carry out what the soul has decided. Almost always. So as you know from your experience, if you decide that your hand should come up, it goes up. If you decide to drink a cup of water, you drink a cup of water. You decide to go for a walk, go for a walk. Of course, it doesn't always work. You're in the middle of a concert, 4,000 people are dead silent listening to the music, and you have to sneeze. And you say, no, I don't want to do this. Please, come on, don't stop! That doesn't help. And you sneeze anyhow. Why? Because God's policy is almost always to cause the body to do what the soul decides. But there are exceptions. If you are exercising strenuously and you catch a cramp in a muscle and you say to your leg, move! And the leg says, no, I'm not moving. I'm just going to cramp up and sit here in pain. So the soul decides and the body doesn't get the right signal from God. It doesn't get the signal the soul wants. But almost always, when you decide to do something, the body carries it out. That's God's policy of causing the body to carry out what the soul decided. So, the person asks for charity. And I say to myself, shall I give him my charity or shall I not give him charity? And I deliberate. I need the money for X. Well, I'm supposed to give it to charity. I can give more money for charity next month, but he needs it now. Who knows if he'll be here now, next month. I deliberate back and forth, and I decide, finally, yes, I'll give him the charity. That's the end of my contribution. That's the soul's contribution, the decision. Then God causes the hand to go in the pocket and pull out the coin. Suppose I had decided not to give the money. What would have happened? Well, God, following his policy of almost always causing the body to do what the soul decides. Had I decided not to give the money, God would have caused the body not to give the money. So, almost always, the body will do what the soul decides. That's enough. That's enough to be responsible. It doesn't have to be that the soul causes the body. It's enough that the body almost always does it. And The person knows that. That gives us responsibility for what the body does, even though we don't cause it to happen. Is everybody with me? So that's the problem of providence. Providence and responsibility, and we can accept the idea that God's providence causes every physical event and still maintain that we are responsible for the motions of the body, what the body does, knowing that God causes the body almost always to carry out what the soul decides. Yeah.
So would you qualify the statement about the word responsible by saying almost always?
Yes, of course. If a person decides and the body doesn't carry it out but does something else, he's surely not responsible for that. But that's not it. That's nothing new. That would be true in any case. Right? I mean, a person has something to do and he suddenly gets a muscle cramp and can't move his arm and can't do it. We don't hold him responsible for that.
We don't, but it seems logically, if the only person, if the only thing has control over his decision, then that's what he would be judged on, I would think.
It's true that in terms of how God evaluates it, that's quite right, but we have no access to that. We have no direct access to a person's decisions. And when we sometimes do, so then we may in fact, you know, if a person commits attempted murder, so then we're not going to let him off as if he didn't do anything. Because we know he made a decision to kill somebody. Yeah.
Well, where does a person's individual responsibility come in? If I misspeak and offend somebody, am I making a decision to do that? I mean, is that a physical act? What if that's not the decision? I didn't want to offend somebody or I didn't plan to do it. That's a physical act. Is that a physical act?
It's certainly a physical act. And of course, you know, in different cultures, certain gestures mean very different things. There's a gesture in some countries where you're looking to hitch a ride with somebody, and in other cultures that gesture can get you a punch in the mouth. And it's the same gesture. If you're traveling in that other country and you make that gesture, now somebody else is upset. So you say, well, you know, I didn't mean to upset you. I wasn't aware that in your culture it has a different meaning. So obviously there, the same is true with if a person catches a cramp on his leg, trips and falls and hits somebody. She says, listen, I wasn't trying to do that. I got a cramp in my leg. That's why I fell. I'm awfully sorry. And usually we don't hold them responsible for that. Because, again, the bottom line is, did he freely choose to do that? No, he didn't freely choose to hit the other person. If so, he's not going to be responsible.
If someone came and they didn't really mean to do it, it looks like they didn't.
Well, if it's very serious, we have ways of dealing with that. If it's a capital crime, he'll have to be warned, and he'll have to answer back to the warning, I know what I'm doing, and I'm doing it anyway. And then we'll know for sure that he meant it. Okay, now that's providence. The other very difficult problem, which two people have mentioned already, and I'll spend a little time on it, is foreknowledge. If God knows the future, how could I possibly have free will? See, here it goes. In 10 seconds, my arm will either go up or stay down. Up or down. 6 seconds to go. Sometimes up, sometimes down. These are hard decisions. 3, 2, 1. Up! Okay, I raised it. Now, God already knew yesterday. He already knew yesterday that I was going to raise my arm. Could I have kept it down? Was that really within my power to keep it down? To keep it down would mean that I have the power to contradict God's knowledge. That sounds peculiar. Isn't God's knowledge absolute, infallible, perfect? If I had the power to keep my arm down, then I would have had the power, because it's possible that God's knowledge would be wrong. Just happens up to me. Doesn't sound right. So the usual thought is, if God really knows the future, including the details, what I'm actually going to do, then I don't have free will. There really weren't two things I could do, raise my arm or keep it down. I really didn't have a choice between two open possibilities. Really, there was only one thing open for me to do. Raise my arm. I may have felt like I was deciding. I may have had the experience of choosing. But we know very well that experiences can be very misleading. Ever since Freud, and if you had studied Rebus Lossolati before Freud, he would have known the same stuff better. And earlier, the fact that it feels to me one way or another doesn't necessarily mean that that's the way it is. It seems that God's foreknowledge contradicts free will because it contradicts having alternatives open to you. Really, the only thing you can do is the thing you did do. Everything else is not really open because it would have contradicted God's knowledge. That's the argument. And, of course, sophomores discovered this after the third beer at about 1 o'clock in the morning. Gosh, you know, if God knew last today, so then I have nothing, no choice. So if Judaism believes in free will, there's a contradiction, so let's get cheeseburgers. That's about how it goes. But the truth is there are at least four different solutions to this problem in Jewish sources, so it's not something for which we should pack up our bags and head for McDonald's. I'll tell you as much as I can in the time remaining. I don't think I'll be able to do all four, but I'll do some of it. There's one radical solution which is important for other things as well, so I'm going to start with that. The problem is we're saying two things. We're saying that we have free will and responsibility on the one hand, and we are saying that God knows the future on the other hand. When we say both of those things, we're in danger of contradicting ourselves. But we could easily get out of it if we stop saying one of those things. If we just give one of them up, then we won't be contradicting ourselves. Now, as a matter of fact, it is a general idea in Jewish sources that, strictly speaking, we can't say anything about God at all. God is infinite in the old medieval sense of unbounded, unlimited in any respect whatsoever. God is beyond all thought, beyond all description, beyond all language, beyond all conception. The Kabbalistic sources talk that way. The philosophical sources talk that way. It's something that the whole tradition agrees upon. So strictly speaking, we shouldn't say that God knows the future. Of course, quiz time. We shouldn't say that God is ignorant of the future either, should we? Because that's more talking about God. Right? We shouldn't say he knows, and we shouldn't say he's ignorant. We just shouldn't say. We should just, like Wittgenstein said at the end of the Tractatus, that of which one cannot speak, one should be silent. Correct. And here, there isn't even a ladder to kick away. There's just nothing to say. So we're not going to say he knows, and we're not going to say that he's ignorant. We're just not going to say. When we recognize that we are not competent to, strictly speaking, say anything about God, we're not going to say that he knows the future, and that in that case there's no contradiction, because we've given up one of the two contradictory propositions. But how could we possibly imagine not talking about God? Isn't the Tanakh, the Bible, filled with descriptions of God? Isn't the Siddur, the Talmud, the Midrash, all of our sources, aren't they filled with descriptions about God? How could you possibly contemplate stopping talking about God? So the answer is that we don't talk about what God is. We talk only about what God does. We talk about his actions. We talk about what he creates, not what he is. Every description, so to speak, of God has to be translated into a description of what he does. Sometimes it's fairly easy, sometimes it's more difficult, but that's the program. The program is to translate everything that seems to be a description of what he is into a description of what he does. So, if we say that God is just, it means that people eventually get what they deserve. If we say he's merciful, it means that people get more time than they deserve, and they get more help than they deserve. If we mean that he's patient, if we say that he's patient, then it means that although certain things have to happen, but there may be a delay. See, the translation is always into a description of things that happen. If we say that he loves the Jewish people, it doesn't mean that he sighs from time to time, contemplating us, and has a flitter flutter in his heart, and so on and so on. That kind of gross anthropomorphism is, of course, incorrect. But it does mean that events that take place favor the Jewish people systematically in certain ways that other nations don't get that kind of treatment. Do so, and will continue to do so. If we speak about God's power, God's unlimited power, we're not talking about bulging muscles, and we're not talking about possessing unlimited nuclear fusion. What we're saying is, things that he does have no limit to what, in terms of what they can include. There's no limitation of what can happen coming from him. If we talk about God's knowledge sounds very much like a description of him. You think of him knowing, but that's a mistake. We can't talk about him at all. So speaking about God's knowing means something like this. It means that everything that happens in the world is coordinated perfectly with everything else that happens. Everything has the right relationship to everything else. But it doesn't speak about actual knowledge existing anywhere. If that's the case, we're not saying that God knows, and we're not saying that God knows, the problem disappears. So, that's one easy way out. Just to say that we're not going to say that God knows, and it's not on the, not because of this problem that we say it, it's a general position. It just happens to very nicely apply to this problem and dissolve it. It doesn't really solve it, it dissolves it. You can't even state the problem. You with me? Then there are ways to solve it. I'll tell you one. There's probably a lot of time for. Let's rehearse the problem. I made a decision to raise my arm. I thought I could have left it down also. The complaint is, if God knew yesterday you're going to raise it, you couldn't really leave it down. Leaving it down would contradict his knowledge. You haven't got the power to contradict this knowledge. Maybe I do. Maybe I do have the power. What will we do with the contradiction? Here's how we'll solve the contradiction. We have to ask, God knows everything, and he knows before it happens. How does he know it? How does he get his knowledge? We think of it naively, he has it, and it's just in him, automatic. But how about the following suggestion? That God gets his knowledge from our actions. We choose, and it is our choice that causes God to know. Actually, Bertrand Russell put this once as a solution to the problem, saying this is, although he was an atheist, but he said this is one complaint you shouldn't have against religion. His analogy was this. Imagine God getting a sneak preview of the future. He can take a sneak preview. He can preview tomorrow. So yesterday, you know, he sort of pulls back the veil, and he takes a preview of tomorrow. And he sees me raising my arm. Ha, he says. That's what Gaffey's going to do. I can see. He's raising his arm. He sees me making my choice and performing my action. Now, if somebody's watching me do what I do, and he learns what I do from the fact that he's watching me, that doesn't restrict me in any way. That doesn't reduce my possibilities in any way. That doesn't reduce my options in any way. I'm acting on my own. He's just watching. My action is the cause, and his knowledge is the effect. His knowledge is the effect. The effect doesn't exert any limitations on its cause. Of course, it's a little odd. I'm choosing today, and he knows yesterday. Somehow, my choice today affects his knowledge yesterday. But we could have a model for that. I don't have a
blackboard, but you can watch the motions to get the idea. Here's how the model will work. God, here's time, going from left to right. And here's the point at which I make my decision to raise my arm. And back here yesterday, God already knew that. Now we have to ask, how does God know it? And here's the answer. The answer comes in three stages. Number one, God is omnipresent. He's present everywhere. He saturates the universe. He fills the universe. The Mali call Almin, as it says. He fills all the worlds. So God is present at every moment and every place, universal. So here, when I make my decision, and my heart goes up, God is there, present, in me, around me, everywhere. And therefore, the decision takes place with his full presence. And he knows it. He knows it instantly as it happens. That's God here. But God is not within our world. I mean, he is, but he's not limited to our world. God is the creator of our world and also, therefore, stands outside our world. So in addition to God being at every point on the timeline, God's essence, so to speak, stands above the timeline. Up here is, so to speak, God's essence. Of course, God's essence and God being in the timeline is all God. It's all one thing. I'm just describing it this way because it has two aspects. So, first shot, first move. At the time when I make my decision, God is present, in me, around me, and therefore instantly knows what I do. But then, that knowledge is available to God's essence above the line. Because it's all God. That's step two. Can you guess what step three is? Now that it's available to God's essence above the line, it's also available to God's presence in the world at every point on the line. From the central processing unit, if you like, the CPU, it then shoots out to God's presence at every point on the line, including points on the line prior to the point at which I made my decision. So yes, God knows yesterday what I will do today, but how does he know? He knows only because I make my choice. God is present at my choice and knows the choice as I make it, because I make it. Then it becomes available to God above time, and then it becomes available to God's presence at all other times, and that's how he knows yesterday. The confusion in the problem is a deep confusion in philosophy. To assume that if A causes B, A must come before B. We naturally assume that. In everyday thinking, that's taken for granted. In philosophy, they have been trying to prove this for hundreds of years, that the cause always comes before the effect. No one has succeeded in doing it. In physics, they actually have cases where they claim, people like Richard Feynman claim, that there are cases in physics where the cause comes after the effect. That being the case, we don't have to be embarrassed by this, if we assert that in this case, there's a cause and the effect is prior. So this is a way to avoid the problem. The choice is free. There really are alternatives open. And it's because the choice causes God's knowledge that there's no contradiction between what God knows and what we choose. Yeah.
The example you just presented, a linear time lock would allow only one possible outcome of any decision.
Why would that be only one possible outcome?
Well, that's my question, I guess.
But the timeline is the line of actual events. It doesn't represent possibility. It only represents actuality. And indeed, there will be only one outcome. But that doesn't say anything about how many outcomes were possible. Right?
So, well, yeah, but that's, I guess that's what I'm asking. Is it possible that there are multiple potential outcomes for a future decision?
Of course.
Does Drew's philosophy allow for this?
Of course. That's what I'm just describing. What I just described is that there were two possibilities. I could have raised my arm or kept it down. Both were possible for me. I chose one, and the fact that God knew did not mean that I didn't have two possible ones. If you want a picture of the total situation, imagine a multiply branching tree in gray, and then imagine a path through the tree in black. The path through the tree in black traces the actual events, and the branches in gray represent the unactualized possibilities, the choice, the paths that we're not taking. Don't confuse that timeline with what could have happened. It's only what actually happened. Yeah.
There should be many different lines like this, and then one line across. Because of the many decisions you have, if you could have also gotten up and jumped up and screamed and raised your...
Okay, but they're all going to branch in the forward direction, right? They're all going to branch in the forward direction.
Right, but God also has to know the decisions too.
Correct, so you have to know the gray and the black. That's very important. Some people try to get out of it by saying God only knows the gray. Right. That will not be our solution.
He knows everything.
That's right, the gray and the black. That's correct, yeah.
If we have to do faith, and our idea of Hashem knowing what we're doing is purely from seeing what we can do, how does Hashem have any kind of control over our lives? And what I'm thinking from what the rabbi said so far is that he doesn't, and which is what's fitting.
Of course he does. No, it's a false implication. But it's a good question. I'll explain it briefly. I'll say two things, if I open the second one. Remember, we're only now talking about the decisions we make, and at most, the body carrying them out. But the consequences, certainly the long-term consequences, those are all free for God to manipulate as he pleases. Right? You invest money in a certain stock. So you're free to do that, and because he follows his policy of causing the body to carry it out, that's where the money will go. But will the stock go up or down? Now let's suppose it's an oil company. He could arrange that they'll discover oil off the coast, and the stock will go through the roof. Or he could arrange a fire in one of their operations, and the stock will fall. He could arrange that by controlling the natural world. So the outcome of your action is still under his control. Now, so he doesn't lose control over your life. Indeed, you could, if you want, think of providence as organizing the conditions under which you make your choices, which means he organizes the alternatives that are facing you. And then you, by your choices, make your steps forward. One last point. We talked about providence, we talked about faith. The big difference between providence and faith is this. Providence means God's choices, which are sensitive. They're sensitive to everything that happens up to the choice. And therefore, if different things precede, the choice could be different. What God causes can be different. Faith is something that's locked in no matter what you do. In both cases, God is exerting control, but there's different kinds of control. Since providence is sensitive to everything that happens up until the moment of causation, if you make a different choice, God has different material to work with, and with different material, he may cause something different to happen. Whereas with respect to faith, nothing can change it. It's locked into place no matter what you do. That's the key difference. Take, as I said, we don't believe him, but providence, we definitely do believe him. Okay.